Welcome back to our afternoon session. Again, we have two speakers in this session, and then we'll break again and then return for our keynote lecture. Let me introduce our speaker, Kamila Pakowska. She's did her MA in philosophy and mathematics at Charles University in Prague, and is also doing her PhD there, although this year she's spending a year in at the University of Edinburgh. Her field is ethics, and her PhD topic is forgiveness as a key to ethical relationship. And today she's going to speak to us on Banker Bulstrode's study of a wrongdoing.
Thank you, Alice. So my paper will be an illustration of how can we use literary examples to show and analyze important aspects of moral experience. My focus will be on a type of wrongdoing which persists to be notoriously puzzling for ethical thinkers. It is the case in which a wrongdoer doesn't see and acknowledge his guilt, and therefore he doesn't repent or feel remorse. The basic problem is that if he doesn't see he has done something wrong, he doesn't do wrong intentionally. Indeed, if he doesn't judge his action wrong, then in a sense he cannot avoid doing wrong. That raises a question about his responsibility for the wrongdoing, and consequently puts in doubt his guilt itself. In order to explain the ground of such guilt, we are going to analyze an excellent example of this type of wrongdoing in George Eliot's novel Middlemarch. One of the main characters there, Banker Bulstrode, becomes guilty of hastening the death of his blackmailer, Mr. Raffles. Nevertheless, we will follow the process in which Bulstrode persuades himself that he doesn't hasten Raffles' death, and therefore that his actions are irreproachable. We will describe the example in the first part of the paper and interpret it in the second part. In the third part, we will analyze Bulstrode's actions in order to face the charge of their being involuntary. Finally, after showing the corruption of Bulstrode's deliberation, we will suggest the sense in which we can hold him responsible and explain his guilt. Let us turn now to a detailed consideration of an example of the kind of wrongdoing we are interested in. Banker Bulstrode is an ambitious and selfish, yet a deeply religious man. He becomes a target of blackmailing and psychological torture from his former employee, Mr. Raffles, who knows about the dishonest way Bulstrode came to his money 30 years ago. Mr. Raffles is a drunkard, and after a serious illness, he is carried into Bulstrode's house. From this moment till the decisive scene, which we are going to read, Bulstrode undergoes a violent inner conflict. Eliot's depiction of this conflict is on page 2 of your handouts. We will just summarize it here. On the one hand, Bulstrode desires Raffles' illness to be fatal. On the other hand, he knows it is not right to help or even desire that. We will focus on a decisive scene in which Bulstrode's strong desire made him disobey two of Dr. Lydgate's orders about Raffles' treatment, that the small doses of opium cease after a definite time, and that the patient must not be given any alcohol. By his disobedience, Bulstrode undoubtedly hastens Raffles' death, in spite of the fact that he shrinks from forming any conscious intention to do so. Just before the decisive scene, we find Bulstrode sitting in his parlour after he has consigned the care of ill Raffles into the hands of his housekeeper, Mrs. Abel. Sleepless and raving Raffles appeared to be in no danger of betraying Bulstrode's secret. Both Ruth is deep in thought, deliberating indecisively whether he should have sent for Dr. Lydgate, who might confirm that the patient's condition has worsened and bring Bulstrode some peace. I'm going to read the passage now. It's on your handouts, page 1. He had sat an hour and a half in this conflict by the firelight only, when a sudden thought made him rise and light the bed candle, which he brought down with him. The thought was that he had not told Mrs. Abel when the doses of opium must cease. He took hold of the candlestick, but stood motionless for a long time. She might already have given him more than Lydgate had prescribed, but it was excusable in him that he should forget part of an order in his present wearied condition. He walked upstairs, candle in hand, not knowing whether he should straightway enter his own room and go to bed, or turn to the patient's room and rectify his omission. He paused in the passage, with his face turned towards Raffles' room, and he could hear him moaning and murmuring. He was not asleep then. Who could know that Lydgate's prescription would not be better disobeyed than followed, since there was still no sleep? He turned into his own room. Before he had quite undressed, Mrs. Abel rapped at the door. He opened it an inch so that he could hear her speak low. "If you please, sir, should I have no brandy nor nothing to give the poor creature? He feels singing away, and nothing else will he swallow, and but little strength in it, if he did, only the opium. And he says more and more that he's sinking down through the earth." To her surprise, Mr. Bulstrode did not answer. A struggle was going on within him. "I think he must die for want of support if he goes on in that way. When I nursed my poor master, Mr. Robinson, I had to give him port wine and brandy constant, and a big glass at a time," added Mrs. Abel, with a touch of remonstrance in her tone. But again, Mr. Bulstrode did not answer immediately, and she continued. "It's not time to spare when people are at death door, nor would you wish it, sir, I'm sure, else I should give him our own bottle of rum as we keep by us. By a sitter-up as you have been, and doing everything in your power." Here, a key was thrust through the inch of doorway, and Mr. Bulstrode said huskily, "That is the key of the wine cooler. You will find plenty of brandy there." Early in the morning, about 6, Mr. Bulstrode rose and spent some time in prayer. Does anyone suppose that private prayer is necessarily candid, necessarily goes to the roots of action? Private prayer is inaudible speech, and speech is representative. Who can represent himself just as he is, even in his own reflections? Bulstrode had not yet unraveled in his thought the confused promptings of the last 24 hours. After this conclusion, perhaps against the reader's expectations, the chapter continues. As if relieved from a burden, Bulstrode goes for a walk in the garden, and he's able to perceive the morning beauty there. When he meets Mrs. Abel, who tells him that Raffles finally fell asleep, Bulstrode nevertheless recognizes the symptoms of approaching death. With a feeling of gladness and relief, he awaits the arrival of Mr. Lydgate. Lydgate is surprised by the sudden turn of Raffles' state, but declares death without further suspicion. Let us proceed to the interpretation of the scene now. It has two major parts and a short supplement. At the end of each major part, one of Dr. Lydgate's orders is disobeyed. This disobedience is, nevertheless, in each case preceded by a significant inner struggle. It reveals Bulstrode's painful deliberation about the two alternatives of action that is, however, unconsciously biased by his desire for Raffles' death. Each part thus uncovers an inner process of producing a biased judgment and biased decision. This finally makes it impossible to describe Bulstrode's action as a conscious disobedience with the intention of hastening Raffles' death. In the first part, this process of thought is explicit in the dialogue of Bulstrode with himself. In the second part, it is only anticipated. The first part begins by Rostrud's becoming conscious that he forgot to tell Mrs. Abel when the doses of opium should cease. It is probable that she has already given him more than prescribed. By that, a part of Lydgate's order is trespassed, which Lydgate explicitly emphasized. In the first motionless pause, Rostrud, with no further agitation, excuses his omission by his wearied condition. Apart from that, he betrays no anxiety about the patient, neither any regret for his forgetfulness. Surprisingly, he starts to hesitate on the way to his room whether he should or should not rectify his omission. Apparently, he has no great inclination to do so. This hesitation grows into the second motionless pause between his and Raffles' room. There, he realizes that even after the previous doses of opium, Raffles is still not asleep. Since opium was given to the patient to help him sleep, Bostrow takes that as evidence that Lydgate's orders are not reliable after all. With no further reason, he decides to go directly to bed. In the second part of the scene, Bostrow's inclination to disobey Lydgate's prescriptions finds encouragement in Mrs. Abel. She knocks on the door of Bostrow's room and tries to persuade him to give Raffles some support in the form of alcohol. She doesn't know that it was explicitly prohibited by Dr. Lydgate. Mrs. Abel, speaking through an inch-open door, produces three very solicitous and compassionate applications. We anticipate Bostrud undergoing a silent internal battle behind the door, similar to that on the stairs. Two times he doesn't make any answer, but the third time he yields to Mrs. Abel's pleadings. His absence from his action is only underlined by Elliot's passive voice formulation. Here, a key was thrust through the inch of doorway. Indeed, it is Mrs. Abel who will administer the alcohol, so Bostrud's action is as indirect as possible. As a supplement to the event at night, we are told that Bostrud spent some time in prayer early in the morning. We are not advised as to the content of the prayer. Nevertheless, Elliot gives us here the key for interpreting Bostrud's actions. She says that even Bostrud himself hasn't yet understood his evil motives, the roots of his actions. He ends up deceived about the nature of his action. Therefore, he doesn't understand his guilt and doesn't repent. Quite the contrary, we find him relieved from the burden of Raffles' blackmailing. But this is the key point. We could see that he has persuaded himself of doing something unobjectionable in disobeying Lydgate's orders. In his long and hesitant deliberation before the actions, he adopted multiple reasons or excuses for doing so. Yet he doesn't see that his true motive actually was his desire for Raffles' death. In that, he's deceived. However, there was neither a conscious intention in him to hasten Raffles' death, neither any deliberation directed to the end. That would indeed make his guilt unquestionable, since intentionally hastening someone's death implies that the person knows he is doing something evil, but fails to care about that, at least in that moment. But Bostrud does care most acutely about his behaving in the moral way and about his being a good person. He wants to be good, thinks he is, but has wishes, egoistic tendencies and promptings. Unfortunately, these promptings escape his notice and control. We cannot even call Bostrud weak-willed, since acting from weak will implies acting against the judgment, whereas here his judgment is in accordance with his action. Bostrud finds his actions justified, though his justification is biased by his egoistic desires. Nor is his action a case of strong, blinding impulse. That could be if his irritation at Raffles grew out of control. But we could see clearly that he spends an abundant time in emotionless deliberation and rational activity. His actions are therefore without doubt intentional and deliberate, though the intention is not to hasten Raffles' death. Certainly, Bostock's actions are wrong, and we should like to hold him guilty. Yet, guilt presupposes some intelligible sense of responsibility. And in Bostock's case, there is serious doubt whether he is responsible for his wrongdoing. Since he himself believes his action justifiable, he doesn't do wrong intentionally. In a sense, he doesn't know he has done something wrong. But can a person be held guilty if his action is involuntary in this sense? We will try to find the answer in the two remaining parts. Let us go back to Bostock's misdeed now and consider his responsibility. What exactly does Bostock do? We saw that there were two subsequent actions. First, he awaits rectifying his instruction to Mrs. Abel about when the doses of opium should cease. Second, he yields to Mrs. Abel to give Raffles some brandy for relief and support. Both of these actions mean that Bostock disobeys Dr. Lydgate's warning, and Bostock is aware of that. Nevertheless, both Bostock's actions have a yet wider description. Both also mean that, in disobeying Dr. Lydgate's orders, he is hastening Raffles' death. We have enough evidence about that from how Lydgate's deliberation and diagnosis are depicted in the novel. It is highly probable that had Lydgate's orders been obeyed, Raffles would have survived. However, Bostock doesn't accept this description of his action. His stance is most apparent in the last insight into his thoughts we are given immediately after Raffles' death. Bostock inwardly exclaims, "And who would say that the death of Raffles had been hastened? Who knew what would have saved him?" It is obvious from these inner utterances that Bostock cast in doubt the reliability of Lydgate's prescriptions and persuaded himself about their uncertainty. By denying the causal link between obeying doctor's orders and the patient's condition, he denies that his two actions were the actions of hastening Raffles' death. It could be objected now that since Bostock doesn't see that his actions hastened Raffles' death, he cannot be properly held responsible for it. Indeed, there is a sense in which he doesn't know what he is doing. Nevertheless, this sense is different from the case in which he is not aware of that. That is the case of Mrs. Abel, who doesn't know Lydgate's orders and satisfies Raffles' request in good faith that there is nothing wrong with it. In that case, there is no ground for blame, since she has hastened Raffles' death involuntarily. Our case is different, though, because Bostock is explicitly warned by Lydgate and the danger of alcohol for Raffles' illness is explained to him. In spite of Lydgate's authority in the case, Bostock comes not to believe to this evidence. He therefore denies the possibility that by disobeying doctor's orders, he could hasten Raffles' death. Thus, instead of saying that he is not aware of what he is doing, we should rather say that he is mistaken about his actions. It is therefore not the case that Bostock hastens Raffles' death involuntarily. Yet, could he have prevented it? In order to answer that question, let us ask now, what is the cause of Bostock's mistake? We know that it was the outcome of his long deliberation in each case. This deliberation was, however, biased by his evil desire. Instead of searching the best alternative of action, it started to bend towards a previously favored solution and modified the reasons for this solution accordingly. Bostock's inclination to disobey Lydgate's orders made him manipulate their justification. We know, however, that this manipulation was never conscious, as well as the operation of Bostock's desire. Its bending influence on Bostock's thought is therefore exerted only covertly. It is crucial here that it is an evil desire. Previously, Bostock himself prohibited the desire to come into action. In his longing for goodness, he has good reason to hide the desire's operation before himself, and so he does in our episode. Thus hidden, the desire's exertions can be manifested only indirectly. It makes Bostroth hesitate where he should act without deliberation. It makes him accept too quickly an excuse for forgetting a part of instruction, and finally, it makes him justify the unreliability of litigate's orders by a reason which by no means grounds evidence, namely, that in spite of doing what litigate prescribed, Raffles was still not asleep. This indirect influence wouldn't be possible had Bulstrode's deliberation been caused by his honest care for Raffles' health. There would be nothing blameworthy in this desire, and no reason to shrink from it. As such, it would have to enter explicitly into Bulstrode's deliberation. While standing on the stairs with a candle, the first question which would have to enter his thought would be, but will Lydgate's prescriptions really help Raffles? And here, we can see that for that question to be possible, he would have to have some previous doubt about Lydgate's authority as a doctor, for example, some bad experience with him. However, there is no such ground at all. The fact that Bulstrode actually does doubt the helpfulness of Lydgate's orders is therefore the product of his evil desire only. Now, could Bulstrode have prevented his evil desire from biasing his deliberation? It was crucial for our argument that its operation on Bulstrode's judgment was unconscious. Thus, he ends up believing in the rightness of his conduct. Yet, if he were able to identify clearly his desire and its influence, condemn it, and set himself to uproot it, he could have prevented its coming into action. For that, however, he would have to concede the viciousness of his inclinations, and that his egoism obstructed. Let us recapitulate. We know that Banker Bulstrode hastened his blackmailer's death. Nevertheless, we follow the way in which his thoughts ended by denying this fact, and therefore denying his guilt as well. In spite of the fact that he cannot be held responsible for explicitly intending to hasten Raffles' death, his doing so is not involuntary. He can be held responsible for desiring it, for failing to fight against his desire, and thus for permitting it to corrupt his decision. Yet, this is not the strong sense of responsibility that we attach to the cases of intentionally doing something wrong. There, we suppose the person could have decided not to act at the moment of action. However, Bulstrode couldn't help his actions in this way. His responsibility is therefore a weaker one, which we attach to people's vices. Eliot designed for Bulstrode the vice of egoism. We can conclude that this vice is ultimately the source of, first, Bulstrode's merciless attitude to Raffles, and second, of his corrupted deliberation in which he shrinks from seeing the wrongness of his actions. Thank you.
First of all, let me thank you for your paper, Camilla. I enjoyed it very much. And also your interpretation of the episode that you discussed. Personally, I've also got a background in moral philosophy and ethical theory, and my comments will accordingly come from this direction. People working in the normative branch of moral philosophy look at actions of persons and ask if these actions are praiseworthy or required or permissible or objectionable from a moral point of view. That is to say, they analyze human behavior with respect to normatively relevant features. And this is also in part what you've been doing in your paper, and it's your approach to interpreting this episode of Middlemarch. And here I want to comment on your paper by adding some normatively relevant aspects to the ones that you already mentioned with regard to the behavior of the character of Nicholas Bulstrode. In contemporary moral philosophy, it's common to think about morality as consisting in certain reasons that people can be thought to have when they reflect on their actions. From this perspective, Wilstrom's behavior appears to be of that sort that most people, including you, Camilla, would like to characterize as somehow incorrect or blameworthy. And in your paper, you give us a number of reasons for why we might think that this is in fact the case. You point out that although Wilstrom does not directly decide to shorten Raphael's life, his decision to disobey the instructions of Dr. Lydgate is based on his self-righteous reasoning, which seems to always favor his own personal preferences and inclinations. The crucial aspect that makes it difficult to assess the blameworthiness of Bulstrode's actions is, as you pointed out, that he convinced himself that he acts in the interest of Raffles when he really is furthering his own goals. The question then to ask what you did is, to what extent can we blame people who are mistaken about their beliefs and about what they have reasons to do? One way of answering this question is to look at the situation in question and to try to find out if we can think or identify any clear, obvious reasons that a character like Bulstrode should have been taken into account, given the circumstances he was in. And like Camilla, I think that one can find such obvious reasons that render Bulstrode's behavior blameworthy and his actions objectionable, if any plausible perception of morality is to be applied to evaluate his behavior at all. However, I do also think that the fact that Mr. Bulstrode is in denial about his true motivation does hardly present a mitigating factor when determining the degree to which he's blameworthy. And here are two ways in which we might explain why Bulstrode is blameworthy and his self-denial does not significantly lessen his guiltiness. Firstly, considering his individual situation, the dilemma Bulstrode is faced with, that is to say, to either benefit from Raphael's death or to give him the best care so that he gets well again, reflects a very familiar problem that moral philosophers try to deal with in their work. The problem is this: moral reasons are often thought to be of an impartial nature, which means that they occur in the third person perspective. However, these third person perspective reasons are to be taken into account by persons that deliberate within their first person perspective. The moral quality of persons' deliberations is therefore often dependent on whether people balance their normative, their private reasons with the impartial moral reasons in a justifiable way. And in this regard, Bulstrode obviously does a bad job. This is because it's hard to see how giving in to someone's private inclinations by convincing oneself that this is also in the best interest of the other person can count as a genuine attempt to be a morally good person at all. Rather, it seems that a lot more anticipating the interest of the other is necessary for honest moral deliberation. And this is why, for example, Immanuel Kant thought that inclinations cannot serve as the basis for all morality, precisely because they often are too self-serving and convenient. Consequently, what Bulstrode, and you said this as well, like many other characters figuring in Middlemarch, is really guilty of, is not being honest about his own motives. Secondly, I think we can assert that from the perspective of Bulstrode, as the guardian of the diseased Raffles, Bulstrode has not fulfilled his obligations that come with such a role in any conceivable sufficient way. We could see this, for instance, as an interpretation of this episode from the perspective of the neo-Aristotelian virtue ethics. Here we would have to say that although Bulstrode voluntarily took on special responsibilities to see to the recovery of Raffles, he obviously does not do a good job as a caretaker of Raffles. This is because Bulstrode did not personally attend to Raffles, nor did he provide any other sort of information necessary to do this for him. Quite to the contrary, Bulstrode even in an unauthorized way alters the instructions given by the physician. None of this can be counted as fitting the description of the responsibilities of a guardian in general. Therefore, Bulstrode's self-delusion cannot serve as much of an excuse either here. Of course, the reader knows about the special relationship that Bulstrode has to Raffles, and in light of this, one could argue that a genuinely moral person would not have taken on these responsibilities with respect to Raffles in the first place. In conclusion, one can therefore say that although Bulstrode's behavior does not amount to direct intentional harming of Raffles, there would have been enough other factors that should have kept him from acting like he did. And since these other considerations appear to be quite obvious reasons, Bulstrode's self-delusion cannot serve as much of an excuse for his actions. Therefore, if his case were to be dealt with legally and his personal relations to Raffles would remain undiscovered, Bulstrode would probably not have been committed of outright murder. However, it seems clear that a jury would nonetheless charge him with negligent homicide, and that as well poses an extremely serious offense. Thanks.
Camilla, rather than say anything or ask a question about the moral situation here, I wanted to invite you to tell us what you think about the fact of George Eliot's, what George Eliot is doing by putting such a case in a literary work. So in other words, I mean, Merton was bringing up the imagining a trial in which, you know, Bulstrode is the court of trial for negligent homicide, would we find him guilty or innocent? What is the difference for you, considering this case, considering it inside a work of literature, what difference does it make that that's the context in which you as a reader are being invited to consider the morality, the details, the ambiguities of this case, as opposed to if you were in the jury, on the one side, if you were in the jury in a trial, or perhaps the other extreme, though maybe I'm canting the question by putting it this way, if you were litigate, or if you were just someone in Bulstrode's world encountering him, you know, if this was happening in real life, you encounter such a case. What are the advantages, or what's the effect of putting such cases in works of literature?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are you asking about the different perspectives we take when we read this kind of story or description of character in a literary work, and the perspective we have towards real wrongdoers that we just meet in ordinary lives? Is that right?
Yes, or if we had to assess, make this kind of assessment that you were making, mm-hmm. but in a highly technical environment such as that of a law court.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Either a very informal environment, such as real life, with no rules, you know, or rules that are much more, or an environment with very restricted rules, and then there's literature, which has its rules. What's the point of making us as readers go through this work of assessing such cases, which she's obviously inviting us to do, Georgia?
I think the main difference between the court and the reading activity we do as readers is that in the court the judges are intended to judge the person's wrongdoing. So their aim in understanding the action is to judge it. Whereas when one reads the novel, you're rather invited to understand the ways in which a wrongdoing can be done, and understand its preconditions. For example, Bulstrode's character, Eliot develops his character in quite a considerable amount of pages, so we have really a deep insight into his past and into his vices. And so I think the Eliot's first objective is not to condemn this kind of wrongdoing, but rather to make the reader understand how it works, and maybe to see himself in the story as well. At least this is my understanding.
And then I agree with that, and then what would the contrast be, do you think, with the real life situation? If we had for a long time been meeting Mr. Bulstrode and observing him, and, you know, so we had this chance to develop it over many pages, as it were.
Well, so the main difference probably is that of importance. I mean, if we meet banker Bulstrode and probably see him doing this wrong, we are almost obliged to respond in some way. Whereas in reading a novel, we are not to act. We are just invited to read it and understand it, think about it. So I would say maybe it's a difference of it's a practical difference, that's it.
I agree, thanks.
So this is something that may be insightful or not, depending on your answer to this question. What year is Middlemarch from?
It's 1871.
Okay, then perhaps. This may be a long shot. In literary studies, at least in German language literary studies, when we work with the 19th century, mm-hmm. one of the things that we concentrate on is this shift between religion and aesthetics, and aesthetics supplanting religion as the new higher form of something great, supplanting morality. So I was really taken with something that you mentioned in the first part about how the next morning he notices his beautiful surroundings, mm-hmm. right? He walks around and he takes it all in and he kind of feels redeemed and feels mm-hmm. okay. And so I saw that as sort of a supplanting, like the opening up of a new kind of ethical paradigm in the story where the traditional morality of right and wrong and letting somebody die and the things that perhaps normally we would consider ethically relevant, mm-hmm. maybe somehow Eliot is trying, in the supplanting of that, with the replacement of this aesthetic ethics, to make a subtle commentary on maybe some of the literary and philosophical trends that were going on at the mm-hmm. time. And that might offer some insight as to why this person would act in this way, mm-hmm. other than to be just sort of a moral cautionary tale.
It's really interesting. I didn't know about this interplay of aesthetics and religion at
this
time.
It's mostly in the German. I mean, Germans are obsessed with it, but I'm not sure if it actually comes into play in English literature at all.
Actually, I would say that Eliot intended this sort of aesthetic comment rather to show that Bulstrode is morally deviant, as we would judge, because previously he was in extreme tension and he was really in an agony of fear what Raffles will do next, and he was sort of stressful person, so he's just in a great tension. And then I think she's trying to show his relief by his ability to perceive I don't know what there is, some morning, some flowers and morning mist and so on. So I'm not sure about the complementary role of aesthetics here, but it is surely important. So thank you very much.
Well, I mean, I don't
know anything about it. Yeah, so it wasn't absolutely clear to me whether Bulstrode is, or to what extent Bulstrode is ignorant of his motivations or the wrongness of what he's doing, I mean, according to Eliot's presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose he is, and then perhaps there's some kind of broadly psychological explanation for his ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Might think that he's in something like, I mean, from a certain perspective, in something like the same position as Mrs. Abel. I mean, both are ignorant, and yet there's some tendency to think there's something wronger about Bulstrode than Mrs. Abel. It's then just, and the question is, what kind of makes the difference in your view,
mm-hmm.
in our assessment? You might think it's something to do with the character of Bulstrode in general, but then that's kind of unfair if he hasn't got control over that. So I just wonder what your view was
mm-hmm.
on the difference between Abel and Bulstrode.
Mm-hmm. I think I should clarify more the way in which he is ignorant about his motive, because and that's why I put the page 2 on your handouts if you care to read it afterwards, because actually Eliot describes his line of thought from the previous day, and it is clear from that he's aware of his desire that Raffles dies. So he's aware of this desire. And he sort of thinks about that, and he says, well, I know I shouldn't wish it, but after all, if I don't act on this desire, it is not that bad. So he somehow excuses this desire. And you can see clearly that he sort of declares that he won't act on this desire. And he does some sort of almost spiritual exercise to prevent this desire to come into action. So he knows he desires death. I mean, it is natural that he knows. But at the decisive moment, he doesn't realize that it is actually this desire that makes him act. So this desire is surely the motive of his action. And I would say this is the basic difference from Mrs. Abel, whom we cannot even suspect of having this motive. So I think the basis of attribution guilt to Burstall is the existence of this motive. Whether I replied.
We have time for one quick question. And if no one else has one, then I want to ask it, okay?
A moral of you.
I mean, back to this issue of the different contexts, I think it's interesting that in the court of law, we would have a kind of artificial imposition of not knowing whether the person is to be judged wrong or right, sort of, until we've assembled all the evidence. So there's a kind of, the point is judgment, and you kind of hold, you're supposed to hold off making the judgment until you have all the evidence in line. But in the novel, it seems to me we make the judgment right away. We know right away, ugh, Bulstrode, ugh, his vice is at work here. You know, so we know that. And so then, I guess for me, that's one of the interesting things about the novel, that it's, in some sense, often the moral question is settled. You know. So, but then why do you keep reading? What is it you still want to know? And you said, well, there's a certain kind of understanding you want. And I think that's right. And it's not, I mean, the other thing is that it's very familiar. What Bulstrode is doing is, I hope I'm not so I'm just puzzling about how you kind of know what's going to happen, and you've done it yourself, and yet it's real. She makes it very interesting. So that's for me kind of the puzzle. But in a way, it's all totally, I think, completely plain that he's, as Merton argued, he's in the wrong here. He is blameworthy. I know it. I've been done it myself. And yet I'm fascinated. How does it work? You know, so I think there's some kind of puzzle about what the understanding is. Or is the novel doing what she says we can't do? I mean, getting to the roots of action. You know, even though the thought is we actually can't do that, but the novel can? Or
maybe what is fascinating about this example is that when we act as he does, as Cecile suggested, we sort of never see it from outside. Mm. And actually, if someone else acts as he did, we don't know as much about him as well, because she depicts his deliberation there, and she depicts his motives. So maybe the advantage of a novel is that we actually never have such deep knowledge of what happens when such wrongdoing is done or such action is done. And I find it very interesting as well. So I'm really glad that you share my enthusiasm with this example.
Well, I hope we should thank Camilla.